Welcome to the Poisoner's Cabinet. I'm Sinead.
And I'm Nick.
And this is your weekly podcast exploring the lives of the great poisoners and macabre murders from across the centuries and creating curious cocktails inspired by the tales that we tell. And it's episode 92!
92 and we're back!
It's
been so long.
It's a Christmas miracle!
That it is.
Tis Christmas Eve!
Tis Christmas Eve, good sir.
Ah, we are back. We are back from our Christmas break. Thank you to everyone who bore with us, who is still here.
Yes, well done. If you're still listening, then I'm very grateful.
We have got a treat in store for you today, for it is our Christmas special. Now, can we possibly top the drunken hilarity that was last year?
You just wait. And I'm gonna have to interrupt now. For it is Christmas, it deserves a Christmassy beverage to start us off with.
Immediately, an immediate
Christmas beverage. To start the episode. So we're going to have a beverage. Pause now.
We need to start the episode with an actual beverage.
Absolutely.
And we've never had a beverage this early, I think.
I know.
Haven't even got to the bits where I ask you how you are and about poisoning and all that.
No.
So to start our Christmas Eve spectacular, what are we having?
Well, you have to wait and see, won't you?
Oh, is it a surprise?
I've got to go and get it first.
Okay, all right then. Well, I think it's time for Nick to dash like Dasher and Prancer and Rudolph and the other reindeers.
And all those other ones.
To the poisoner's cabinet kitchen to shake up a storm for the first time, so we'll see you in a bit.
See you in a bit.
And we're back.
Hello, for the first time.
So if you listen to last year's Christmas episode, you know that we kind of go live with this stuff. It's on the fly. This is the first Christmas episode we've done together, because last year we were in lockdown.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
We were separated, but Nick has dashed into the kitchen, as I said, like the proverbial reindeer, and come out with, is it bloody eggnog?
It's bloody eggnog.
It's eggnog.
My first time I've ever had or in fact made eggnog.
Oh my gosh. So I've been asking people, should we be having eggnog? I've never had eggnog.
Have you ever had eggnog?
No,
never have.
The Christmassiest of drinks, and we've never tried it. And I was a bit disturbed because Nick closed the door to the kitchen and I could just hear something grating furiously. I'm really excited. So do we taste first?
Yeah, absolutely. Just give it a
go. And then you're going to give us a secret recipe.
I'm terrified and intrigued.
I'm excited. Okay, well, yeah. Cheers.
Cheers.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
I like that.
That's not entirely unpleasant.
That is my cup of tea. Oh, yeah, I see why that's popular. It's not sophisticated. God damn, tasty. Do I detect a hint of nutmeg, Nick?
A sprinkling of nutmeg.
So what is in eggnog?
Well, eggs.
Just eggs.
And nog. Mixed together vigorously. I have grated... This is not nutmeg, this is nog.
Oh, nog. Nog and a nog.
I've grated a nog.
They are found in the forests.
Yes. Now, this is a recipe that was posted on the Instagram by Kate Can Do History. So thank you very much for recommending this recipe, because that's what I went with. So eggs, whole eggs, double cream, milk,
ooh,
cognac, Grand Marnier,
wow,
bourbon,
whoa,
spices. I made this yesterday. It was a long time ago.
This is the Colonel's secret spices.
Yes, secret spices. All blended up together.
Oh my gosh.
Into a blendy drink.
That is lovely.
Yeah,
I'm into eggnog, people.
Yeah,
I'm worried about the rest of whatever else we're drinking today.
Who knows?
Because this curdle, I don't know. But I mean, a little sip, another one. Oh, it smells of Christmas.
It does. It is very Christmassy.
Yeah.
And it's not as heavy as I thought it was going to be.
You know, it's like a Bailey's. It's like
it is a pretty much
velvety drink.
It's a version on a flip, really, isn't it? And we've had, it's basically a drink with a whole egg and spirits that goes back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. So this is just a pimped up version of that, really, with Christmassy spices and stuff.
I love that eggnog is a pimped up version of the flip. There it is on Pimp My Ride.
Yep.
Driving around in a low rider. Yeah, I'm Christmas in a glass.
All those spices and
wonderful recipe as well.
Oh, yeah.
Well done. Thank you so much, Kate. This is
so moving on to the next bit of the podcast.
And it will, as we have our drinks in hand. How are you, Nick?
I'm very well. Even better with a glass of eggnog in hand. It's going to be Christmas soon, so that's already fun.
Obviously, everyone around the world is having Christmas a little differently
this
year.
True.
It's not as savage as last year. Last year, because of where we are in the UK, we had full-on lockdown. We couldn't see each other. We couldn't do anything. We were confined to our homes. We had to record in secret. This year, we have restrictions. Obviously, Omicron, per CIA, is prevalent. So wherever you are, we hope you're being safe. We hope you're okay. And if you are alone, if you had to isolate because of the virus, it's most important for you to be safe. But we hope that we can bring you some joy today. So, but just eat, drink and be merry. But you're full of the Christmas spirit. That's yes. wonderful. Well, speaking of being in the Christmas spirit and being eternally alone inside, let's thank our wonderful, wonderful Patreon subscribers.
Indeed, we should. And there are a great many this week. People have flocked to the Patreon. So thank you, you darlings. So the first of all, we must thank Heather Hill.
Christine A. Wido.
Leah Maskey.
Victoria McPhee.
Steph.
Heidi Sleeman.
Stephanie D.
Elliot Rivers.
Ian Shrivers.
Christy.
K.D. Anderson.
And Laura Filch. Thank you. You are so, so sexy, all of you. Thank you for joining us on Patreon.
We hope you're having a lovely time out there. A good one this week. It was a thinker.
Yes, this week we did an unsolved murder in Ireland, a very famous one that's been the subject of documentaries that have been out this year. And it had its 25th anniversary, this case, this week. So it just coincided beautifully. And if you haven't joined us on Patreon, come over in the festive period. It's a great way to escape your family. Well, Nick.
Yes.
Are you ready? To drink cocktails and talk about poison.
I already have my cocktail.
Or we could drink poison and talk about cocktails for Christmas.
It's not Christmassy enough, I feel, poison.
No. Yay, okay, we'll go with the first one. Hooray, hooray, hooray. Well, before, though, we get into the whole cocktail business, Nick, would you like some Christmas facts?
Oh, this is unexpected.
You know I love a little Christmas fact.
You do, tell me your Christmas facts.
Last year I talked a lot about what the medieval Christmassy celebrations were. A little bit meld into the modern, but I went very medieval last
year.
Would you like to know a little bit about what the Victorians did?
I would be delighted.
Oh, good.
Tell me.
So the real start of the Christmas traditions that we know and love in England in particular, and then filtered through to America, started in the Victorian era.
It did.
So the tradition of having a Christmas tree in your house was from Queen Victoria and Prince Albert.
That's true, because he was German.
He was German, and the Germans had Christmas trees in the house. And there was an article in a magazine, not so much a newspaper, sort of a magazine at the time, where there was a sketch of Queen Victoria and Prince Albert with their beautiful tree, and everyone went, I want one of those.
Yeah.
So went out cutting down oaks and sycamores and everything, dragging it into the house and going, look, it's so pretty. At the time, the tradition of Christmas lights on your tree, again, shows people did not really do their research so much in England. You did have to use candles because you didn't have lights.
Yes,
and they went, let's put candles all over the tree, resulting in many, many fires.
Many deaths
and fires at Christmas because people went, it's so beautiful and magical. Let's go to bed and just not deal with this at all.
This flaming bush in the corner.
Also, the introduction of Christmas cards.
This is true. Another Victorian invention.
Yeah, and again from Queen Victoria, started sending out Christmas cards, and all the little children went, I want to do that too. Yeah. Christmas crackers, 1848, was thought as a really good way to sell sweets.
And it worked.
First it was about sweets, but then it became tiny, tiny screwdrivers and protractors in the Victorian era, obviously. They were huge screwdrivers at the time. It was, oh God, crackers were very, very dangerous back then. The gifts that were given were food and sweet things. Usually, and you would adorn the tree with them. So, yes. You know, you've got kind of candy canes or... And the Victorian era was the start of feasting and the turkey. The turkey being served, or the goose.
The goose.
Is all Dickens' fault. If you've read A Christmas Carol, you'll know the pain of that, that it took about four pages to describe that fucking Christmas table layout. Sitting in school going, Dickens, you're very, very good at conjuring a scene, but this is too much.
It's getting a bit carried away now.
But it's, yeah, that abundance and that feasting made everyone go, oh, that's the spirit of Christmas. There shall be all sorts of things. And again, if you're a bit poor, then you're like, oh no, I want to be able to have that opulence.
That's the spirit of Christmas. Being rich and buying things like no one else can afford.
So there you go. There are my little Victorian Christmas facts.
How delightful.
Oh, everybody is happy now, I'm sure, knowing where all of the gluttony came from. But we do have a story to tell today, don't we, Nick?
We do.
It's a story. I don't know if anyone knows it.
Oh. I think some people may have possibly heard about it in passing, potentially.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an obscure one, so hopefully you'll go with us, guys. But we'll come back to that, because as we've established, we can't possibly tell a story without a cocktail in hand. As you know, dear listeners, every week we choose a secret ingredient that is inspired by the tale that we tell and will flavour our cocktail of the week. So, Big story, big episode.
Yeah.
Our secret ingredient this week, Nick, was...
Whitechapel.
Whitechapel itself.
Yes, indeed.
Quite the inspiration. I'm slightly worried about the flavours that Victorian Whitechapel might conjure up. Yes, terrifying, but Whitechapel itself, the inspiration.
Yeah.
What have you come up with?
Well, a London Calling.
I love that. London Calling. London forget call. The Clash, forget yeah. the Clash, forget no, the Clash.
That's the only thing that comes into my mind when I say that.
Forget the 80s. London is calling
London
you.
London is calling.
To the foggy streets of Whitechapel.
Exactly.
Yes, let's go with that. Yeah, put that in your mind, people. Ooh, London Calling. I like that. I am excited.
Also very Eurovision as well, isn't it?
Oh my God, it is.
Hey, this is London Calling.
Well, I think it's time again for us to go into the poisonous cabinet kitchen and shake up a storm. So we'll see you in a minute.
Yes, we shall.
And we're back.
Hello.
So, Nick, is London calling?
London is calling, indeed.
Ooh, it's a nice citrusy-looking drink. That's the only thing I can describe it as.
Yes.
Nice. Okay, so a little sniff.
Let's give it a go.
Ooh, it smells citrusy. Dive in. Merry Christmas,
Merry
Nick.
Merry Christmas.
Ooh.
Meh.
No, I don't mind that.
Oh, it's fine. There's nothing special.
It had a really nice citrusy start. Then it kind of came away into nothingness.
It's a bit bleh.
It's fine.
It's fine.
I'm quite happy with that after the eggnog, to be fair.
It's cutting through the richness of the eggnog.
Yes. I was worried that you were going to give something really bold and ballsy, and I'd be like, I can't, my taste buds can't cope. I don't know. But no, I'm quite happy with that now.
This is a highly curated cocktail playlist we've got going on.
So I'm liking this right now. Yeah. I think this is a very good interim drink.
It's fine.
Talk us through it.
We have a base of gin. We have lemon, as you have suggested. We have a bit of sugar. We have some sherry. In there.
Sherry?
A Christmassy twang.
That is very Christmassy.
And a dash of orange bitters.
I like that.
I mean, I think it's perfectly fine. It's nothing spectacular.
No.
But it's a perfectly pleasant drink.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. It is a good, steady drink. Nick, is it time for a story?
It is indeed time for a story.
I wonder what our story
what
could be.
What could it possibly be?
What could it possibly be?
Well, there is. I feel there is no use pretending any longer. Because if people haven't guessed from this week's secret ingredient what's going on, you will probably know from the title of the episode. So at long, 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 long last, we are telling the story of Jack the Ripper.
Da, da, da.
We've been putting it off, waiting for the right time, and for some reason, Christmas Eve is the right time for Jack the Ripper. So let's go for it. For one of the most famous killers in all of history.
Well, I do have a Christmassy Jack the Ripper quote when ready.
Okay, fine. We've got something to look forward to.
Yes, and it's wonderful. But let's start with the goddamn facts, Nick.
Right, indeed. Well, over the past couple of years, we have discovered that a great many of the people we have covered are or have been suspects for the Ripper murders. Some of these are plausible-ish. Some of them entirely fanciful. So we are going to take a little look back at some of these people we have covered and introduce a whole host of new suspects as well. And I have no doubt that by the end of this, Sinead and I will have categorically identified one of the most infamous unknown killers of all time.
It's going to happen.
We will have solved the mystery of Jack the Ripper in the next hour.
And most of you are going, that's not going to happen. Tiny, tiny bit of your brain for a split second went, I bet you they could.
Oh, yeah, we could do it. We could do it.
Yeah, we could do it.
So everyone knows a little bit about the Jack the Ripper murders. We are not going to spend too much time detailing the crimes. There are many, 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 many books, films, podcasts, documentaries, comics, all sorts of things.
There are.
There are many giving huge details about the crimes. And more recently, there has been a shift to a focus on the victims as well, telling the stories of the women who have become known as the Canonical Five. Mary Ann Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes and Mary Jane Kelly. So, Victorian London. If you're poor, it is not a fun place to be.
It isn't?
It's not a jolly time if you have no cash.
There are no top hats and charming kids just selling your chestnuts.
There are plenty of that if you have the money to pay for it.
Oh.
In the mid-19th century, people are flooding into London from all over the world. Thousands of people who have come in from Ireland because of the famine. We have Jewish refugees who have come in from Russia and Eastern Europe, escaping the pogroms. Population has exploded. These people arrive with nothing, and in a time well before the welfare state, they crammed into any space they could find. Today, the district of Whitechapel has a population of around 15,000 people. In 1888, the population was over 80,000 people.
Oh, bloody hell.
And this is a very small area.
It really is.
You're looking like perhaps five or six streets, yeah. sort of thing. So it's not a big district, really, at all.
Any tourist who comes to London going, let us see the streets of Whitechapel, expecting probably in their head a combination of some slums and St. Paul's Cathedral.
Yeah. No.
It's not. It's a tiny, tiny area of the east end of London.
One main road and a few side streets off it. That's Whitechapel. Before you move into Spitalfields and Bow and Limehouse and all the other areas that make up the east end.
Aye.
So it's not a big place. Crime and violence are incredibly commonplace. And the crippling poverty that everyone endured in the area drove many, many women to prostitution just to survive. It is estimated that in 1888, there are 62 brothels and around 1,200 women working as prostitutes in Whitechapel alone.
That is,
and as we said, it's not a big place.
That is saturating the market, and I literally and figuratively... Yeah. Whoa. Well,
that's like every other house.
That seems a lot.
It does seem an awful lot. And whether that this was a figure from the Metropolitan Police, so whether it was them sort of slightly over-egging.
Yes.
But that's the number they came out with anyway.
They just looked down the street and went, I think there's about 17 yeah. million brothels down there. That's it. Shut it down.
It like, all looks what? Dreadful.
So. It's not a pretty place at all.
On Friday the 31st of August, 1888, at 3:40 a.m, the body of Mary Ann Nichols is discovered in Bucks Row. Her face is bruised, her throat has been cut by two deep slashes, one of which went all the way down to the bone. Her stomach has been cut open and her bowels exposed, and they later, in a post-mortem, find two stab wounds to her vagina. The violence and the fury of the attack is shocking, but unfortunately not overly uncommon in the East End. And the resulting investigation is somewhat less than thorough.
Hazards of the job.
Hazards of the job, indeed.
As they would say.
There's not a huge amount of concern that's going on here. One week later, though, on Saturday the 8th of September, the body of Annie Chapman is discovered in the backyard of 29 Hanbury Street. Like Mary Ann, her throat has been severed by two deep cuts and her abdomen cut open. A section of the flesh from her stomach had been placed on her left shoulder, and another section of skin and flesh, plus her small intestines, had been arranged above her right shoulder in a strangely grotesque manner. The subsequent autopsy also reveals that Chapman's uterus and sections of her bladder and vagina have been surgically removed. Now, after now two nearly identical murders, the police are starting to pay a bit more attention, thinking that there's something going awry here. At the inquest into Chapman's murder, a witness describes having seen Chapman standing outside 29 Hanbury Street at about 5:30 that morning, and she was in the company of a dark-haired man wearing a brown deerstalker and a dark overcoat. He was of a shabby, genteel appearance, she said. The man had asked Chapman a question. Will you? He had said. To which Chapman had replied, yes. That was all the conversation she heard. The police took that to the nth degree, again assuming that Annie Chapman was involved in some sort of prostitution and had been propositioned by this client. She was accepting his terms. So basically, she was asking for it. These two murders so close to each other had been picked up on now by the papers as well.
Because murder in Whitechapel is not uncommon.
It's not uncommon, but two so violent.
The manner in which they were killed and the strange arrangement ain't so normal.
Ain't so normal, absolutely. So this has certainly been picked up on.
A stab and run, horrible as it is, not uncommon.
Yep.
Arranging a body like that, okay.
In a slightly ritualistic potential vibe, it's very weird, that's unusual. So the papers are going to pick up on that, and obviously we know that the tabloid press are nothing but reasonable and understated in their reporting of many crimes, so in no time the public have been whipped up into a terrified frenzy. Now by mid-September, the public are getting more and more frustrated that the police have not got anywhere there with their investigations, and they actually decide to take things into their own hands. And the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee is established. it is a very grand and pompous name for a group of vigilantes, really, who will roam the streets of Whitechapel hunting for the Ripper.
I'm sensing they didn't do a good job knowing where this story is going.
Yes.
They were like, yes, vigilantes, you have to bring your own sack of knobs, you know, doorknobs with it. No, it's what did they think? What did they do? Did they do anything?
Well, they sort of patrolled the streets. Hoping to deter.
To run into Jack the Ripper.
Further attacks, hoping to catch someone in the act.
Yeah.
Not successfully.
I mean, if you are a murderer, you are going to clock the roaming band of vigilantes and probably commit your crimes two streets over.
Well, whoever Jack was, they absolutely did just that. On the 27th of September, a letter is received at the Central News Agency. Dear boss, I keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I have laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about leather apron gave me real fits. I am down on whores and I shan't be ripping them till I do get buckled. Grand work the last job was. I gave the lady no time to squeal. How can they catch me now? I love my work and I want to start again. You will soon hear of me with my funny little games. I saved some of the proper red stuff in a ginger beer bottle over the last job to write with, but it went thick like glue and I can't use it. Red ink is fit enough, I hope. The next job I shall do, I shall clip the lady's ears off and send to the police officers, just for jolly. Keep this letter back till I do a bit more work, then give it out straight. My knife's so nice and sharp, I want to get to work right away if I get a chance. Good luck. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper. Now, initially, this letter is considered a hoax by everyone who sees it.
Yeah.
But 2 days later, on the 30th of September, Jack the Ripper strikes again, twice, in the infamous double event.
The double event. Topic of much debate, this
Well, indeed it is. And you'll soon see why. Elizabeth Stride's body is discovered in the early morning of the 30th in Dutfield's yard. The cause of death is a single 6-inch incision across her neck. Now, unlike the murders of Mary Ann Nichols and Annie Chapman, there are no further mutilations to her body, leaving questions as to whether Stride's murder really was committed by the Ripper, or whether in fact it was and he had been interrupted during his attack and continue his work, or it was someone else entirely different. Several witnesses later informed police that they had seen Elizabeth in the company of a man in the early hours of the 30th, but each give differing descriptions. Some said that her companion was fair, others say he was dark, some that he was shabbily dressed, others that he was really well dressed, so no one's entirely sure. He was with a man. No one knows what he looked like. Could be a beggar, could be the fucking king. Who knows?
Well, this is the time, of course, where they've been reporting Jack the Ripper, or there is a murderer on the loose in Whitechapel. So anyone you speak to, oh, I saw him there. 10 feet tall he was. Chunk of hair, red. There he was. No, he was a midget. He was walking around. Oh, he seemed a bit weird. He was like blonde, a little bit. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. He had a limp. He had one eye. He had seven eyes.
Yeah. Is that probably the description varied on depending on which magazine they had read that morning and, as to what Jack the Ripper was supposedly looked like.
And again, how much money you paid, because people are saying, like, do you want a witness statement? They say, oh, well, I saw something, give me a few coins, and then they'll tell you whatever you want.
Now, less than an hour after the discovery of Elizabeth Stride's body, the body of Catherine Eddowes is found in the corner of Mitre Square.
Oh, yes.
Sinead's very excited about this one for some reason. So her throat is severed from ear to ear. Her abdomen ripped open by long, deep, jagged wounds. Her intestines placed over her right shoulder. A section of intestine placed between her body and her left arm. So some of it is cut out and sort of put under her arm. The left kidney and most of Edo's uterus has also been removed. And her face has been completely disfigured. Her nose cut off. Her cheeks slashed. Her eyelids cut open. And part of her right ear had been cut away. Now this right ear clue led police to believe that the Dear Boss letter that they had received was in fact genuine. Until now he had been convinced it was a hoax, but the writer had said he would clip the lady's ear off, and that seems to be exactly what he had done. They were in communication with Jack the Ripper. A trail of blood led the police to a doorway nearby, where they found a piece of Catherine Eddowes's bloody apron on the floor, and a message written in chalk on the wall, reading, "The Jews are not the men to be blamed for nothing." And the message seemed to imply that a Jew was responsible for the murders. And fearing that this graffiti would incite violence towards the Jewish community in Whitechapel, the head of the Metropolitan Police, Sir Charles Warren, ordered it to be washed off before it could be seen by anyone.
I will have notes on that.
So I have comments about this man.
I have notes.
The day after the murder of Stride and Eddowes, another note is received by the Central News Agency. In what has become known as the Saucy Jack postcard, the Ripper takes credit for the double murder, and it is he who in fact calls it the double event. Later on the 15th of October, George Husk, the chairman of the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee.
Oh, yes.
That delightful group of vigilantes.
He's been brilliant,
he's been
obviously.
Great, he's been desperately effective.
Yep.
But he receives a package with the return address from hell.
I wonder what's in the package.
And at this point, I have paused to make another cocktail.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
But you can't leave us on tenterhooks now. What's in the goddamn package, Nick?
You'll have to find out.
Something from hell?
With another cocktail.
Oh, what if it's a fluffy bunny?
Fluffy bunny from hell.
Fluffy bunny from hell. That's actually terrifying. That sounds terrifying.
That's worse. Some sort of human bunny.
Here's some lovely notepads, and it's well timed because we've just finished that cocktail.
Well, exactly. It was all desperately planned out.
So what is our next cocktail?
The next cocktail we're going to have is what the hell?
What the hell?
What the hell? Which I'm sure he said when he received the package. What the hell?
What the hell?
What the hell is this?
Anyway, it's from hell. What? You're in my mind. Okay. What the hell? I'm worried now. Yeah. Well, as we pause on tenterhooks for the rest of the story. Oh my god, it's so good. We have to dash into the poisonous cabinet kitchen and yet again shake up a storm for Christmas. So we'll see you in a minute.
See you in a minute.
And we're back.
Hello again.
With another cocktail from hell.
From hell indeed.
Well, what the hell, Nick?
What the hell?
What the hell is this? Well, it looks quite nice.
Yeah.
It looks golden.
Golden.
Golden in its hue. Pretty. Looks can be deceiving.
Indeed.
So, this is a what the hell. I'm expecting a reaction. I want a reaction from this now.
Yeah.
But let us dive in with the third cocktail of the day.
Here we go.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas again.
Okay. Ooh. Ooh.
That has more of a reaction than the other one.
It has more of a reaction. Okay, I don't know what's happening.
Mm.
It's not as violent as some other cocktails we've had.
Yeah. I'm not a fan.
You're not?
No.
I don't mind it.
It's all right. I know what's in it, and there's too much of one ingredient.
Ah. It's got elderflower in it, hasn't it?
Nope.
Fuck.
Such confidence there.
Well, in that case, I don't know.
Okay, so we have, again, London cocktail needs gin. So we have gin.
Yeah.
We have dry vermouth.
Yeah.
We have lime.
Yeah.
We have sugar.
Yeah.
We have apricot brandy.
Wait.
It's the apricot brandy, which I think you're mistaking for the elderflower, which there's too much. I think it needs to drop down that, and you might be all right. Well, more for you then.
It's fine.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
anyway,
yeah.
Back to Jack.
Back to Jack. Yay.
And a delightful, delightful package. The dear Mr. George Lusk has just received.
Oh my god. Yay.
Mr. Lusk, I send you half the kidney I took from one woman, preserved it for you. The other piece I fried and ate. It was very nice.
Sorry, I knew it was coming.
I may send you the bloody knife that took it out, if only you'll wait a while longer. Catch me when you can, Mr. Lusk.
Also, you just going, it was very nice.
It's very nice.
It's very nice. It's literally how you have cocktails. That's the thing. Read Dear Boss letters in a slightly different voice, and they're very, very funny.
Mr. Lusk was not happy about receiving such a letter.
I wouldn't be either.
Yeah, I mean, he and his gangs of vigilantes have been out there for weeks now, searching down this man to no avail, and now he's been taunted in his own home.
I mean, it's a massive FU.
Yeah,
to him.
Absolutely.
He is proclaimed himself to be the head of vigilantes. He's going to hunt down Jack the Ripper. But it's probably a human kidney that
Absolutely.
He's been sent. This person is not pulling any punches.
No, indeed. Now, the final victim from the canonical five was Mary Jane Kelly. She's discovered on the 9th of November, lying on the bed in the single room that she lived in 13 Miller's Court. Her face has been so heavily mutilated that it is almost impossible to identify her. Her throat has been severed down to the spine. Her abdomen almost emptied, pretty much, of its internal organs. Her uterus, kidneys, one breast placed beneath her head. Her heart is missing entirely. Now, there are many other victims that some people ascribe to Jack the Ripper. Martha Tabram, Emma Elizabeth Smith, Rose Mylett, Anna McKenzie, Francis Coles, and the unknown victim, who became known as the Pinchin Street Torso, who we have covered previously. But authorities remain convinced that only Mary Ann Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Jane Kelly were the victims of the Ripper, and all the others are unrelated or even copycats. In 1894, Sir Melville McNaughton, the Assistant Chief Constable of the Metropolitan Police and the head of the Criminal Investigation Department, wrote that the Whitechapel murderer had five victims and five victims only. Detectives interviewed over 2,000 people. 300 people were investigated and 80 were detained over the months, but not a single arrest was made. So who was the Whitechapel murderer? Who was Jack the Ripper? Now, I do know Sinead has some possible suspects up her sleeves.
Possibly.
She maybe has one or two people that she's going to tell us about.
So a wonderful summary of Jack the Ripper's victims. We urge you to read about them, to read The Five, the recent book about them, and to learn about the victims, because these were innocent women, did not deserve to be murdered.
No
one deserves to be murdered, but the rhetoric around their deaths at the time of them being prostitutes seemed to imply that they had brought this horror on themselves, and it is not true. Jack the Ripper, for all of his mystery, for all of the fascination around him, was a murderer, was a serial killing fuckhead, quite frankly.
As the technical description goes.
It is the technical description. But we are going to cover off some of the suspects, because who the hell
was
Jack the Ripper? So many elements of this story have passed into folklore. So many people and ripperologists. Over the years, there have been people who have obtained, in inverted commas, I'll say, evidence. To them, they have attained the evidence, and they have come up with new theories that have been literally, and I'm not even kidding, turned into film and TV even before they've been written about books and turned into an actual theory about them. The subject of some of the great graphic novels of our time, great films, numerous books out there. So there's so much source material on Jack. We couldn't possibly cover it all in one episode. But the suspects are many, many, many Ripper suspects over the years. More than 100 have been named, have been seriously credited as Jack the Ripper suspects. You can pick them apart at any point. Everyone has a favourite. Some of you out there might have favourites too. You might have favourite elements of this story. And if you want us to talk about it a bit more in detail, if you want us to cover some of your favourite suspects, if you'd like to hear our spin on any elements of this crime, do get in touch, because we will consider doing an extra Patreon episode on Jack the Ripper. But for now, we are going to cover some of the favourite suspects of ours of Jack the Ripper. So as it's Christmas, Nick, yes. I did want to read you something I found. Found this on a Jack the Ripper Tour website. This is a Jack the Ripper Tour that you can imagine. There are many, many in London. And they have a piece about Christmas with Jack the Ripper.
Nice. Fun times.
So this was printed in the Western Morning News on the 27th of December, 1888. So they pondered how Jack the Ripper might have spent his Christmas.
Nice.
This is but a few lines. Jack the Ripper did not spend his Christmas following the pleasures of using the knife. Translation, he did fuck all. This was, however, a dire dread that he would gratify his thirst for blood by dispatching another person in Whitechapel. But it was with a sense of relief that one found that he had spent his Christmas in a civilized manner.
That is, he had a civilized Christmas. I'm glad to hear it.
I mean, that is padding
really
in
is.
Every sense of the word as a journalist going, what is Jack the Ripper maybe doing at Christmas? Well, he hasn't killed anyone. He's probably spent Christmas in quite a civilized way. So let's all picture Jack the Ripper just cozied up in front of the fire with a good book and a sherry.
That is someone desperate on Boxing Day for an article for the next day, isn't it? I've got this little column that I need to fill, so come on!
So as we said, we're going to cover some of our favourite suspects in the Jack the Ripper cases. We've had some mad suspects on the show. Surprisingly, even from the early episodes of The Poisonous Cabinet, whoever we encountered was purported to be a Ripper suspect for very tenuous reasons. We've had the likes of Lizzie Halliday, who was a lady in America. Quite a few people talk about, was Jack the Ripper a woman? Was Jack the Ripper potentially a midwife?
Yes, indeed. That's a big one that's come up.
It's a big one. The basis of it, not so much in actual fact or evidence, but the idea that whoever committed these crimes had some degree of surgical knowledge to the point where they could dissect in such a clean manner, they identified all of the organs.
And a gentleman would never have done such a thing.
Oh, a gentleman never would have done such a thing.
An Englishman would not do such a thing.
So there's lots of ideas that was a midwife perhaps exacting some sort of terrible punishment on prostitutes, not founded in any fact or evidence. But they did attribute this to Lizzie Halliday, who we have covered. They just assumed when she was convicted, because she was a woman, she'd killed lots of people, she could be Jack the Ripper.
Absolutely.
Yes, she definitely sailed across the Atlantic and back, killed a bunch of people without being seen and never commented on, and then came back and then was arrested in America. Absolutely fine.
Entirely possible.
Indeed. Another crazy, crazy version. People still kind of go, So another famous suspect was Thomas Neill Cream. Very famous serial killer.
Yes, the poisoner indeed.
The poisoner of episode 11 that we covered.
Quite a change of tack if he's now ripping people.
Absolutely. The thing that made people think, oh, is he Jack the Ripper, were his famous last words. As he was on the scaffold, he apparently said, "I am Jack," and then was cut off when the rope stretched. So were people thinking that he was saying, "I am Jack the Ripper"? It was a last confession. I mean, people will jump on anything.
Oh, yes.
You know, more likely he was going, "I am ejaculating." No, it's genuine. This is genuine. It's not that he was ejaculating in the sense that we know, is that he is just spouting words, that he was just going, "I'm ejaculating."
Okay, fine. I thought you said he wasn't saying that.
No, he was trying to say, "I'm ejaculating."
He was saying, "I'm ejaculating."
Some people said, no, but it wasn't used in the same way that it is now.
Really?
Well, why would he say, "I am Jack"?
Well,
unless he's just going, "Screw it, I'm Jack the Ripper."
Why the hell not? Bit more notoriety.
He was an American who did come to London, murdered at least 5 prostitutes with poisoned beer. He was in America in jail at the time of all the killings.
That is problematic.
Yes.
That's what you call an alibi, I feel.
Yes. But don't let the facts get in the way of a good suspect story,
not.
Nick. No, no, no. The Ripperologists would have you believe, certain ones, we love some of you, that his sentence was served by a lookalike.
Okay.
Purely so he could travel over to London and kill a bunch of people and then come back and then finish his sentence.
I mean, it's possible.
It's a theory.
Should we put that in the maybe pile?
Very much in the maybe pile, yes. Disputed by his lawyers, his family, and him. But one of the other big suspects in Jack the Ripper is George Chapman.
Yes, now that is a name that is very familiar.
It is very familiar, for he was covered way back when, Nick, in one of our earliest episodes, episode 6, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. George Chapman, he was Polish, was a serial killer, known as the Borough Poisoner. So back in his home country, he had trained as a surgeon. So ticks the box, the idea that whoever killed the 5 had surgical knowledge. But he came to London in either 1887...
Yeah.
Or 1888, he would end up living in the East End.
Yeah.
He moved back and forth from America over his lifetime. But when he was in London, he was a surgeon barber, ended up as a pub landlord. But over his time in England, also in Poland, he had several lovers, wives, people, multiple marriages and multiple lovers. Was violent, yeah. was a horrible, horrible man, threatening the people he was with, saying that he would cut their heads off and he would do terrible things to them. He started killing his women. So killing, singing, dancing, cutting hair, killing, singing, dancing. It was just a big cycle in the 1890s and the 1900s. And when he was caught, it was Inspector Aberline.
The most
famous detective involved in the Jack the Ripper case. This is many years later, who came up to the officer who arrested him and said, "Congratulations, you have caught Jack the Ripper at last." Oh. Aberline himself was obsessed with George Chapman, saying that he just rang so many bells in his head. He was convinced that the timelines matched up. There were so many similarities. He thought that George Chapman was the killer. The coincidences were too much. So he thought that George Chapman was the man that they were after. Apparently, when living in the East End of London as well, at the time of the killings, Chapman would go out in the night for hours on end, unaccounted for, according to his wife/girlfriend at the time. He wasn't an official wife. He matched the description that was given of the last man seen with Mary Jane Kelly. When he left for the USA, the killing stopped.
I mean, that's fairly damning evidence there, really, isn't it?
So George Chapman, I won't say his Polish name because I can't pronounce it right now, but we have covered it again in a previous episode, and all of his killings, that it's a fascinating case. His is the strongest of actual genuine evidence,
yes,
rather
indeed.
Than just surmising around it. He fits the description of a man who murdered another girl in 1902, a man who stabbed a prostitute and tried to cut out her uterus during their encounter. So there's a lot of other circumstantial stuff that links it to him. The stumbling block was that people have not been able to get over, and they couldn't at the time, maybe this day and age they could, was that he was caught, George Chapman was hanged, for poisoning women.
It is quite a leap, isn't it? Because obviously Jack the Ripper is so, so violent, so frenzied, it would seem, in his attack. To go from a poisoning to a vicious knife crime is a massive leap.
The reports in George Chapman's case are that he was violent. He spoke violently. He spoke about terrible trauma he would inflict on the women he was with. So would George Chapman change his MO as a serial killer from poisoning women to mutilating them? Is it that he started mutilating women and he got too much press attention, which maybe he liked, but then he thought, oh, you know what, I'll change to poisoning? Is he that sophisticated? Is he that intelligent to be able to do that? Because it's commented on many times that serial killers don't change their modus operandi.
So I can almost see it going the other way, in that sort of starting to poison people, realising you can get away with it, and then getting slightly more violent in a sort of progression. But almost going from a knife to poisoning, almost in a bizarre way, it feels like going backwards. And so I can't see that, doesn't seem to compute in my head, that you're going, I've spent time slashing up people and cutting their organs out, and now I'm going to stop doing that, and I'm going to poison them in a subtle and surreptitious way. Seems a bit...
Unless he's a criminal mastermind.
Unless... Well, that is true. Unless he is an absolute criminal genius, the likes of which we have never seen before.
That's the thing. That's the thing. If you want to pin it on George Chapman, then you have to go with, does not fit the MO, is a completely unique case.
Yeah, this is
so
very true.
Nick, do you have any other
suspects? Well, as you know, there are, as you said, there are many, many, many different suspects. And a few of them which are quite sad suspects, who are suspects in nothing but sort of coincidence, really. One of those, a chap called Montague John Druitt. So Druitt, but he was one of the favourite suspects of Sir Melville McNaughton, the head of the CID.
Great name.
Yeah, absolutely. Druitt was his top of the list to be Jack the Ripper. And it seems to be such a bizarre assumption that this Druitt would be. Now, Druitt was a barrister who also worked as an assistant schoolmaster in Blackheath in London. His body had been dragged from the Thames on December the 31st, 1888, an apparent suicide, which had been committed just a week after the murder of Mary Jane Kelly, the last of the canonical five. Now, it would seem that this timing is the only thing that really connects Druitt to the Ripper. Is this coincidence that a week later, Druitt decides to commit suicide? And this is something that McNaughton grabs hold of in his assumptions of who the Ripper is. Now, it turns out that Druitt had been fired from his job as assistant schoolmaster. Some modern authors believe that Druitt, in fact, may have been gay, which was the reason behind his dismissal. And people say that it was that, rather than guilt over five murders, that caused his suicide. Even Inspector Aberline had dismissed Druitt entirely as a serious suspect due to lack of any substantial evidence apart from the timing. He had discovered that Druitt had been playing cricket in Dorset on September the 1st, 1888, the day after the first of the murders. He was playing cricket in Dorset, so they thought that could have been a tricky sort of thing to jump on a train and go and have a nice game of cricket after you've committed your first murder.
And no one who plays cricket could be an evil
and
man.
No, well, exactly. Only a gentleman plays cricket, and no gentleman could possibly commit such a horrible, horrible murder. But he's still up there in the list of suspects due to Sir Melville being absolutely certain that Druitt was the one.
This is the thing, though, with the Ripper suspects, is that if you were named at any point, people latch onto them. They still stay in the list,
the pantheon of people.
Absolutely, the pantheon of people who were implicated in the Ripper murder. So people can revisit them and go, well, what if someone missed something? Yes. What if someone missed something? Modern Ripperologists are desperate to find out everyone who was implicated because they think that they will find that one little thing. And a lot of it was just a case of, oh, you died or you were in the area at the same sort of time. Must be you.
Now, another one that I came across, which I had heard about, thought, ah, that's nonsense, that's utter nonsense. But the more I actually read, I thought, ooh, there may be something, there may be something in this.
Nick's going to crack it. Nick's going to crack it.
H.H. Holmes.
Oh, fuck off. What? No.
There's more to this than I had initially thought there would be, I have to say.
When you say it, I'm thinking, oh, they went, oh my God, H.H. Holmes, he was a bastard, probably sailed over like Lizzie Halliday, Thomas Neal Cream, but yeah. No.
I was surprised about what similarities there are there. So, I mean, obviously a name that is almost as famous as Jack the Ripper. Now, it turns out that Holmes has left diaries, and they are now in the possession of his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson, and they have been published, and they are there, and they have been authenticated as belonging to Holmes. And entries in these diaries confirm that he, in fact, was in London during the time of the Ripper murders.
Okay.
So he was around. He was in London at the time.
People were in London.
I was
going to say that.
But it seems bizarre that two such crazy, crazy serial killers were in the same place at the same time.
Fair.
So that maybe got me thinking, going, ooh, I didn't know that. I didn't know he was actually in London.
I mean, are they authentic? Are they?
No, apparently 100%. So says Google. So says the interweb.
Yeah.
That these are legitimate things, and there is evidence that he is not in America at this time. He has travelled elsewhere.
Fair enough.
But obviously, as with Chapman, the sort of the characteristics of the murders are very, very, very different. Holmes is a very calm, organised, methodical murderer. He's generally there for an insurance payout or some sort of profit. Jack is opportunistic, frenzied.
Yeah, I will say, and go with me on
this. Okay, I'm going.
What happens on holiday stays on holiday.
he was trying out some new ideas.
Can you imagine, though, H.H. Holmes has a very methodical process on his home soil. He goes abroad. No one knows me. I'm just going to go crazy. Yeah. I'm just going to go crazy.
Going to go mad. This stuff I can't do at home.
There is a tiny bit of it where you go, maybe he just went abroad and went, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, you know. and just went mad. You can see it happening.
He had medical knowledge.
He was
a trained pharmacist. He had medical experience. He had medical knowledge.
Stop trying to convince me to this, because it's not fucking H.H. Holmes.
It's not, but it's actually more compelling than you realise.
Oh, it is, yeah. I find that more compelling than some of the other stuff I'm about to say.
So not long after the murder of Mary Ann Kenny, there is a ship's log, only a week later, that reveals that H. Holmes leaves England for America.
See, this is the recurring thing, is that whoever left England, whoever left the territory just after the murders, people think it must be them because they just stopped. If you follow the logic of the five.
Yes, absolutely.
We have talked about on this show, we've covered other murders, which really seem to stack up with if Jack the Ripper continued.
There are a great many names that people think Jack the Ripper didn't just stop. He carried on and on, and eventually he died or he got sent away for something else.
Yeah.
But he killed a great many other number of people and started before as well. Martha Tabram and things was before.
Way before. And then afterwards, we've talked about, you know, the torso murders we talked about in Westminster and everything. That seems crazy that wouldn't have been Jack the Ripper. But the idea is that there were only five. There were only five.
And I can
understand the police saying that. Yeah. I can understand the authorities saying, don't panic. That's it. Nothing else happened after this. But then you go, and they left at the same time, so it must have been them. So anyone who was in the vicinity or died or left is the Ripper. So I will counter that.
Okay.
With another delicious family of suspects, Nick.
A whole family of them.
An entire family of suspects.
Okay, I'm intrigued.
Very famous, very tenuous. It's stacked up because of some theories and books later published behind it. We're going to talk about the Maybricks. Nick.
Okay. Oh, we've had them before.
So we talked about Florence Maybrick on the show. Florence Maybrick, who was convicted of poisoning her husband, James Maybrick. So this was same sort of era, same sort of time frame. Florence Maybrick was a very, very famous case at the time. Controversial, widely thought that Florence was wrongly accused of poisoning her husband and that James had died from overdosing on his favoured medical poisonings. He took strychnine. He took all sorts of those poisons Florence helped him get those. He died. She was convicted of his murder. She spent her time in jail. She protested her innocence. She was originally sentenced to death, and then she was released. But more than 100 years later, claims emerged that James Maybrick was, in fact, Jack the Ripper, based on a diary. A diary that was discovered and purportedly written by him that detailed the killings of the five. The diary came into the hands of a man who got it from another man at a pub. I want to go to this pub.
Yeah, where's this pub?
Yeah. These are labourers, and the guy was an out-of-work scaffolder, and someone else gave him the diary. What pub is it where you can go in and labourers are just handing around historical evidence to infamous murder cases? I want to go there. The diary has been through numerous tests. With a lot of the modern evidence that has emerged, it always comes out, it's not completely determined that it wasn't a hoax, but this was a fucking hoax, excuse me. I'm going to just go out and say it. Most people believe it's bollocks. There's testing on the ink and the paper that it definitely was a historical document, but not at the time frame that they say it was. And then there's also testimonies that the person who received it said his wife dictated it to him. And then he retracted that and said, no, she didn't. No, she didn't. It's just a bit weird. More interesting, I think, and I didn't find a lot of information on this, a pocket watch that was owned by James Maybrick. He had a pocket watch. There was a pocket watch, let's just say, J. Maybrick. Also, the initials of the five and the words, I am Jack.
That's a bold sort of thing to have engraved on a watch.
Doesn't that sound a bit weird?
Yeah.
But tests that have been done on that watch say that while they cannot prove conclusively that it was from that time, there have been people who've studied it. The way the engravings and the brass and everything, the way you scratch it into it, be very hard to fake. It's interesting. So that's James Maybrick. But the Maybrick story leads into another element of this. Another suspect emerged from this case and forms part of the bigger conspiracy theory.
Oh, we love a conspiracy.
Around Jack. The Ripper was being protected and even directed by the Freemasons.
Of course. They're all over it.
So the idea that the Freemasons are involved in the Ripper murders, in the Ripper cover-up, in inverted commas, is a very, very commonly held belief, and it's something that is permeated into modern society beyond the fascination that people have, or the Ripperologists have, with this case. But where we come back to the Maybricks is that this hinges on a book that the famous film director Bruce Robinson wrote. He wrote a book called They All Love Jack, and in it he points the finger firmly at James Maybrick's brother, Michael, as the real culprit. Now, in this book, Bruce Robinson goes hammer and tongs at the idea that Freemasons were involved in covering up the real identity of Jack the Ripper. And I'm going to build on this later. But the conspiracy theorists leap on the Ripper case with gusto. It beggars belief that such a horrific murderer could have escaped justice from the cramped confines of Whitechapel, with London's finest detectives on the case, unless there was some circle of protection around the killer. The idea that Jack the Ripper was a Freemason or was protected by the Freemasons has been embraced and explored by many Ripperologists.
It's and a Johnny Depp. He was in there.
So, yes. This will be sending alarm bells off with people going, oh, from hell, from hell, from hell. I will come back to it. Trust me. It's, you know what? It's a fun theory to go with if you're on the outside of Ripper knowledge. If you're listening to this and you're kind of going, I can't even delve into this. It's the fun side of Ripperology. If you're not too concerned about the facts and more about the conspiracy theories, go with me on this, bitches. So was Jack the Ripper really Brother Jack? We all know of the Freemasons, I'm sure. Big Boys Members Club allegedly include all members of high profile, high society, powerful businessmen, politicians, royalty. Allegedly employing all manner of rituals and strange traditions at their lodge meetings, secret handshakes, that sort of thing, initiation ceremonies, as well as ancient rules about, well, being gutted if you break the rules. Freemasons literally run the country in these people's minds. Yep. You cannot get past them unless you're one of them. So it's common fact that plenty of high-ranking officials at the time of the Jack the Ripper murders would have been in the Masons. So does that mean that Jack was a member of the Masons, or was he trying to implicate the Masons in his crimes? So let's go back to the famous graffiti. Jews are the men that will not be blamed for nothing, or the Jews are not the men who will not be blamed for nothing. There's lots of different interpretations of that. So the spelling of that graffiti has really foxed ripperologists for years. So written on the walls, it's J-U-W-E-S, the Jews. So some people think that is someone who is illiterate. As we talked about, there is a lot of anti-Semitism around this case. People feel very strongly, so people get very reactive. It's highly likely that someone, unfortunately, was pointing some sort of finger at the Jewish community. The piece of leather apron that was found at the crime scene, some people think it was a leather apron because there was a Jewish man in the community, a man named John Pizer, who was known as Leather Apron. He was a Jew, he was a butcher. They were trying to leave signifieds around the crime scene to implicate a Jewish man. Mm-hmm. However, there is a potential nod that the Freemasons' involvement to this case is in that graffiti. The graffiti was removed by the police shortly after it appeared, purportedly to stop anti-Semitic bad feeling being stirred up by the public. But the message could have been a reference that Jack was Jewish, or that Jack had written it to the nod to the Jews, or that he was referencing the Freemasons. So one theory is that Jews, spelt in that particular way, J-U-W-E-S, is a reference to the three killers of Hebram Abiff.
Is there the founder of the Masons or something?
He's a very prominent figure of the Masons. Mm. And the three killers were Jubela, Jubilo, Jubilem. It's referencing the Freemasons. What brings us back to Michael Maybrick? Bruce Robinson, in his writing, surmises that Michael Maybrick was either Jack the Ripper himself or purportedly set up the debunked Dear Boss letters in order to frame his brother and his sister-in-law to bring them down. This is based on the fact that Michael Maybrick was the grand organist for the Freemasons' Grand Lodge at the time. But in this theory that he says that Michael could have been killing these women, the way that the women were killed and their organs were arranged around their heads, all those pieces, hark back to Freemason rituals. So why would Jack do that? Either Jack was a Freemason and giving a symbol to anyone who's investigating the case, knowing that there were Freemasons involved, going, I'm giving you a calling card. Okay. I'm saying don't. I'm one of you. And I'm going to fuck up some shit. Or it's a two fingers up at the Freemasons. You were like, no.
I'm like, no, none of that.
But why did he arrange all the organs and the body parts around? It's a very particular way, and some people think it is a nod to ritualistic killings.
It's difficult, though. I'm not sure. So if everyone is sort of makes the assumption that these are arranged sort of, on the over the left shoulder and over the right shoulder, could it just be that that's where just things were dumped?
No, I don't. I think it was quite particular. I'm with the. He arranged them a particular way. I don't necessarily think it was a nod to the Freemasons. I think he did something, but it does hold water. The idea that, if I do it in a particular way, it's like the handshake. Like, get me off this charge. If you want to believe that, If you want to believe that's how powerful. The theory is that Michael Maybrick, he happened to be in all the locations at the right time of all of the killings, including the later killing that was attributed to Jack the Ripper, was a seven-year-old in Bradford, Johnny Gill, which was a horrific murder, and the child was arranged in a kind of a ritualistic way. Michael Maybrick was there at the time.
Yeah, I'm not entirely convinced by that one, I must say.
All right, what are your theories, Nick?
Well, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. But there are a couple of interesting that deserve a bit of time. Francis Tumblety. Francis Tumblety?
Francis Tumblety?
Yeah.
Isn't he a rabbit who lives in the woods?
He's an American chap who has made an absolute fortune in the States, posing as an Indian herb doctor. He is the definition of the word quack. He has been connected to the deaths of one of his patients in Boston, but has managed to escape prosecution and actually flee to London. Now, Tumblety, in his many conversations with the police and with friends, has freely admitted to just generally despising all women. He is not a fan of the fairer sex, but he claims to have a particular hatred for prostitutes.
Okay. Yeah.
And at one time, he actually hosts a dinner party in Washington, at which he displays a collection of preserved female reproductive organs.
Oh, Jesus.
Boasting in dinner conversation that they have come from every class of woman. But while in England in 1888, Tumblety is arrested on November the 7th on charges of gross indecency. Oh. Now, we don't know what that gross indecency involved. There is some speculation that it might actually be he was engaged in homosexuality.
Scandalous.
But while he's actually awaiting trial, he flees to France, and from there he returns to the United States. Now, he doesn't get connected with the Ripper case until 1913.
Of course.
So quite a bit later, when Chief Inspector John Litchfield of the Metropolitan Police actually raises him as a suspect. Again, the evidence is somewhat lacking. He was in London at the time of the murders.
Bastard.
He had an obvious hatred towards women, and he has his collection of preserved internal organs to maintain. Most experts today, probably not. It's probably not him. One of the reasons was being that his appearance matches none of the eyewitnesses' descriptions. Even the people who go, oh, he was tall, oh, he was short, oh, he was fair, he was dark, going, well, that's not him. So it's like, and another thing, you see a picture of him, and he is quite a distinctive character. He's got this massive grey moustache.
Great big bushy
moustache, and the really pointy hat type thing.
Well, that'll make you stand out.
Exactly. I mean, that was what they said, that he is a very conspicuous individual.
Did he put this on before he was photographed?
Oh, well, I don't know. Perhaps it was a fancy dress party he was going to
look
or something.
Look at me, like, oh, I'm never going to be... If you think I'm committing a crime, like, let me put this on before I take the photograph.
Very conspicuous, flamboyant character. So people have gone, nice. Oh, if it was him, we would have seen the moustache coming. So he has been generally dismissed as a suspect. Now we also have another person who is mentioned quite frequently as a suspect for the Ripper, who should probably be in the as bollocks category, is Charles Ludwig Dodgson. Okay. Are you familiar with Charles Ludwig Dodgson?
And it rings a bell. Oh.
Well, as you should. A man who is also known as Lewis Carroll.
Fuck off, no!
The pen name, yes, Lewis Carroll was his pen name. Original name, Charles Ludwig Dodgson. Obviously, the author of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. I had never connected him with Jack the Ripper.
No, I hadn't
before,
either.
Until researching this, and I thought, ooh, that's intriguing.
I knew him and Tolkien got drunk in the Eagle in Oxford, and that was it. And I'm like, well, that's a great way to come
before
up with books.
Before that, he killed many, many women.
Many, many women.
This entire theory came about in 1996. A chap called Richard Wallace wrote a book called Jack the Ripper. Lighthearted Fiend was the title of his book, where he names Lewis Carroll and an accomplice of his, a chap called Thomas Bane, as Jack the Ripper. Now, Wallace claims to have discovered many hidden messages within Lewis Carroll's writings that point to him being Jack the Ripper.
Did he?
Well, you say did he. Wallace went to great lengths to rearrange passages, thinking they were anagrams and secret codes, and to pull out specific hints that he was Jack. In one book, he manages to extract a line that he interprets as reading, "If I find one street whore, you know what will happen? 'Twill be off with her head."
What?
And that's how he extrapolates this message from Lewis's Carroll's writing.
Okay.
Another passage that he comes up with, a passage that originally reads, "So we went to the cook and we got her to make a saucer full of nice oatmeal porridge. And then we called Dash into the house and we said, 'Now, Dash, you're going to have your birthday treat.' We expected Dash would jump for joy, but he didn't one bit." Not what? Particularly Jack the Rippery.
What?
That was the passage that Lewis Carroll had written. Richard Wallace reinterpreted this to say, "Oh, we Thomas Bain, Charles Dodgson, coited into the slain nude body, expected to taste, devour, enjoy a nice meal of dead whore's uterus. We made do, found it awful, wan and tough like a worn, dirty goat hog. We both threw it out, Jack the Ripper."
What? Is that genuine?
That is genuine. That apparently is genuine. Those letters in that original passage can be reconfigured.
That's amazing.
To create that sentence paragraph.
My mind is outblown. Every theory that I've had is fucking Lewis Carroll now. It's Lewis Carroll.
I mean, I have to say it is entirely all bollocks.
Don't you just give me the candle and take it away, Nick.
It is amazing what you can rearrange to suit your own needs, really. In an article that was written to promote this book's publication, Wallace himself was quoted and had written this excerpt, and an eagle-eyed reader had himself reinterpreted this passage to say, "The truth is this, I, Richard Wallace, stabbed and killed and muted Nicole Brown in cold blood, severing her throat with my rusty shiv strokes. I set up Orenthal James Simpson, who is utterly innocent of this murder. P.S. I also wrote Shakespeare sonnets and a lot of Francis Bacon's works too." Thus proving that really you can make any anagram you like out of someone's work.
Yes.
It was not Lewis Carroll.
That's amazing. I love it when people find anagrams in work.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It's
and a whole
so
book
good.
About this. And oh. Another thing he said was apparently the Ripper cut off the noses of some of his victims because Lewis Carroll's mother had a large nose.
That's bollocks.
But no, this is evidence. I think you'll find it's evidence.
That's very good. Oh, I like the idea that Lewis
people
Carroll.
Believe it. People are out there going, "Oh yeah, that makes sense." No,
well,
it doesn't.
The further we delve into conspiracy theories, the more people seem to embrace the story of the Ripper. So let's come to the next suspect. Prince Albert Victor.
It was him.
Duke of Clarence. Son of Edward VII. So described by a historian, Prince Eddie he was called, was certainly dear and good, kind and considerate. He was also backward and utterly listless. He was self-indulgent and not punctual.
Oh dear.
He had been given no proper education, and as a result he was interested in nothing. He was as heedless and aimless as a gleaming goldfish in a crystal bowl. So yeah, okay. Not a great indictment of
this. Yeah, not great, not good.
Prince Albert was involved in a few near-miss scandals, shall we say, during his life, which makes people think that there was something going on with Albert that was connected to the Ripper murders. So some people think Albert was the Ripper. They just put it out there. Others think he was involved. So he was implicated in the Cleveland Street scandal. It uncovered a male brothel in London.
Ooh, oh my God. Such a thing.
He was implicated in this scandal, covered up, though, by the royal family. Reported in the American press and international press that there had been goings on there. His name was never completely entered into these press articles, but enough to implicate that all was not well with Albert.
Indeed.
Theories about Albert would not be fully brought to the fore until the 1970s, when, as has been alluded to, more normal ripperologist came to the fore going, here's what happened.
Here's
I'm
idea.
Pretty confident of what's going on. Writer Dr. Thomas Stowell claimed that Albert had syphilis during the time of the massacres, and he was driven mad, and he had taken to the streets, and he had ripped women apart. This was the theory around Albert. And the royal family apparently let him get on with it.
Yeah, just go for it.
Absolutely mate. Fine. Boys will be boys. Until the double murderer. Oh no, that's just too much. That's too much. You...
Just getting carried away there.
Took him in to a mental asylum. He broke out, killed Mary Kelly, and then went back in, and then he died later on. It was claimed that Albert was gay. Mm. That he had contracted syphilis from some sort of illicit encounter from the various spaces he'd visited. And that he'd taken to destroying women. But the fact is, Albert wasn't in London at the time of any of these killings.
That's
there are multiple reports of the royal records of all of his visits. He was somewhere else around the country. Many people will go, no, they can be forged. They can be forged. Yeah. Albert was there killing people with his twirly moustache.
He sent his minions.
All of these series, as we said, came out in the 60s and 70s. Very convenient to sell books. So we have the theories that Albert is the Ripper, but we also have that Albert is a secondary player in the Ripper killings, and that the killings were done to protect the royal family. The most famous story around the royal family is from Stephen Knight's The Final Solution, which was published in the 70s.
Mm, yes.
In which he alleged the killer was actually Sir William Gull.
William Gull. Ian Holm.
Ian Holm in From Hell. Okay, so we're up. So this is where we come into the territory where most of you may have learnt about the various Ripper theories from the fantastic graphic novel From Hell by Alan Moore. It was made into a film with Johnny Depp in 2001. There have been mini-series based on this, but there is an enduring theory that the Ripper was a member of the royal family's staff, and they assigned the blame with Sir William Gull, who was the physician in ordinary to Queen Victoria. Very talented, brilliant man, big advocate for women's places in medical profession. He fits the bill as a skilled doctor and someone of high patronage. It was proposed, if you want to go down that big story route, that Prince Albert had fallen in love with a common girl, Annie Crook. They had had a child together. She was pregnant. They had maybe married in secret. Some say that Mary Kelly, the final victim, was a witness. Yeah. When the royal family found out, Albert was taken away. Annie was also committed to a mental asylum and was effectively lobotomized to shut her up. But Dr. Sir William Gull stepped in to do away with all the women who were linked to Annie or who knew of the union. But they were killed in a Masonic ritual as a nod to the royal family, who were members of the Freemasons, and they did it as a ritual to try and throw people off the scent. This is the basis for From Hell by Alan Moore, very good graphic novel. Prince Albert as well, in 1891, was said to be involved with a chorus girl called Lydia Miller, who committed suicide by drinking carbolic acid.
Well, that'll do it.
He wanted to live with her, it was said, but the scandal has been hushed up by the royal family, and it wasn't the first, it wouldn't be the last. The theory of the royal family and Sir William Gull has been wildly debunked as too fantastical to make sense.
Yeah.
It's a juicy theory, if not a particularly solid one. But how could have Jack gotten away with it? Quite possibly the perpetrator died shortly after his final act.
Yeah.
Or maybe he continued committing terrible crimes. But what makes Jack the Ripper so compelling? What do you think, Nick?
I have to say, despite my initial positivity that we were going to crack this evening, not entirely sure that we have. I don't think there is some grand conspiracy.
I think the story of Prince Albert and that there was a conspiracy theory there is wonderful.
Oh, it's a lovely story.
I don't think it's true. How did Jack the Ripper get away with this?
A lot of people got away with a lot of shit back then. There's a lot of dead people, a lot of people who weren't brought to justice. So I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility. But
I think that's the key thing, is that people are really flummoxed by why did Jack the Ripper stop? Because of the nature of the attacks, the gruesome elements of the attacks, they are slightly ritualistic, you know, the placing of the organs around the body. Maybe he had just chosen, or she had just chosen, a way to display their handiwork. Maybe they were sending a message. Maybe they were subconsciously going, you know what, if I do it in this way, I've learnt enough about the Masons, I'll try and implicate someone really in high office. They weren't a mason themselves. Who knows? Who knows? So what do you think, people? Who was Jack the Ripper, in your opinion? Do you think we have covered enough of this story? Would you like to hear more from us on Patreon? Send us a message. Why is Jack the Ripper so compelling after all of these years? Send us your suggestions. Comment on wherever you listen to this podcast. Tell us what you think of it. But more importantly, make up all of the cocktails that we've made cocktails today.
As you can tell, Sinead has enjoyed them greatly.
I don't know where I am or where my hands are, Nick.
It's all going horribly, horribly wrong. But they are a good bunch of cocktails. The recipes will be out this evening for you to enjoy on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, wherever you are. Have some eggnog. It's not half bad, actually. We love it.
Send us your Christmassy pictures. We'd love to see them. We'll send you some as well. And make sure you're enjoying the festive season. Thanks for listening, guys. We have been the people inside the poisoner's cabinet. We will see you next week. And remember, your loved ones are trying to kill you.
Bye.